Well, 223 lessons, that's over 4 years. And we're in John chapter 12, and there are 21 chapters. Yeah, right. So what we'll have, I think we get down into the end of our study, we'll find we're going to spend lots of time in John, because in John we have the great teachings. In fact, our next lesson that we're going to get into, the next lesson, is an extensive section in John that we'll study. So, see, today I don't even have John listed. John does not record a temple cleansing. This temple cleansing, he records the first temple cleansing. These three guys do not record the first temple cleansing, but record the last temple cleansing. So there's been all kinds of discussion about whether this was the same event or not. And if you tend to look at the scripture as being somewhat flexible, you tend to think they, not me, tend to think that this is the same event. But it's impossible. They're totally different parts of the ministry of Jesus. So we have actually two temple cleansings, and I think it'll make sense if we look at the text as we have all the way through. So we're to the point of the temple cleansing today. And we know we're studying all four gospels. We now call it the Passion Week. Got to remind ourselves during the Passion Week, it is a picture, what we have in the Old Testament is a picture of what Jesus is actually going to live through, die for. And Paul calls it Jesus is a Passover. So that is something we want to remember. And as the death angel passed over the children of Israel, whose house the blood was put on the doorpost and the lintel, if that blood of Christ is on our hearts or are on our figuratively on our doorpost and lintels, you know, our entryway, our door heart, then we have the same protection that those people did in the Exodus. So there really is a picture of our salvation. And so it's a great picture to fall back on. Now let's talk a little bit about just how we got to where we are. The entry into Jerusalem is after coming from Jericho. Remember the blind man and Zacchaeus? He spent a night in Bethany, and then Jesus calls for the donkey, which he had read about in the Old Testament, the foal that is predicted in the prophets. They take him into the city as the pattern of the Passover observance. The lamb is presented to the family, that's the Jewish family, as the lamb of choice to be slain after 4 days of public observation. Now, this is the occasion that Israel will have to publicly examine the lamb for disqualifying blemishes or other imperfections. That's what the family would do. They would set aside the lamb and watch it for 4 days. Now, we have to assume, because the crowds voiced their choice of the lamb, they make their way into the city with palm branches, cast down their clothing, all represented a full welcome and approval, and we might say unknowingly or perhaps with wrong motives. True, but they still did it. So we had the triumphal entry. The difficult part is getting the week straight. Gives me the feelings when I teach this stuff, like taking off an airplane when it's cloudy and foggy. You say, well, let's go up and see what it looks like. And I think, well, we're going to jump into the week the way I think it is and hope it works out. So I'm fully aware that I may make some blundering mistakes along the way here, but we'll try not to, because our tack is going to be different than a lot of the commentaries, so that makes it difficult because you have to go against what they say. I believe that the triumphal entry occurred on Friday, and we have the next day, a Saturday, which is a Sabbath. It's difficult for me to use the word Saturday and Sunday for these days because that's not what they called them. They called it Saturday was the Sabbath. So in order for you to understand what we're talking about, I use the Western word here, all our pagan symbology here in our days of the week. Remember, that's where they come from, Saturn. Saturday, a visit to the temple observes. Jesus observes the abuse and the commerce that goes on there. That's the day he says he walks in, he looks around and left because it was getting late. So that's all we have on that day. That's my assumption. That's a Sabbath day. You don't expect much to happen on the Sabbath day because it is the Sabbath day. So the next day, the first day of the week, Jesus approaches the city, curses the fig tree on the way in. And that's where we are now in our lesson. So we're on our Sunday day, the cleansing of the temple day. Remember last week we did a little bit of monkeying around with the order of things. We did the lesson of the fig tree last week, which included the Sunday morning event and the Monday morning event, which we're not up to yet. But I do want to do those in a package, so just keep yourselves straight here. The cursing occurs today, but tomorrow they're going to notice that the fig tree has withered. And in the lesson we had last week. So our section today is on the day of the fig tree cursing. That is Sunday, the first day of the week. And we have it pictured for you. This works. Oh, doesn't work the way I expected. Maybe this will work. That does. So last week we basically covered these two events. And now we're going to come back and pick up what's happening in this day. And then we'll come out this way. But there's quite a bit of material that's going to happen after the Greeks visit here. So don't get too anxious that we're going to leave John soon. In fact, I'm trying to toy with the idea of how am I going to deal with this, because I want to teach one more lesson. Then we got Easter. Then I'm going to be gone for 4 weeks. So I may wait with that whole section and wait till I get back. I could let Larry teach, but then I wouldn't get to teach it. That wouldn't be right. Then I wonder what was in that section anyway, because I wouldn't even be here to him teach. All right, so we know where we are, I hope. Now, stick my head out a little further. Jesus is on a mission on the Sunday, the next day. Remember, he stuck his head into the temple, saw what was going on. So I think the next day, he's on a mission. Perhaps Jesus, having observed the temple exploitations yesterday, Saturday, is now on an emotionally charged divine, don't get human here, well, inhuman mission, emotionally charged divine mission to deal with what's going on in the temple. I don't think we have any problem with Jesus being upset, even angry with what's going on. I don't mean that he's out of control. I don't mean that he is falling into a sinful pattern like we would when we get upset. We maybe move into that. And I don't mean that every time we're upset, we're moving to a sinful pattern. There are certain things that are upsetting. I always think about Lot was vexed when he lived in Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, that he was upset with what was going on. So we can have that. And I think Jesus is emotionally charged properly when he saw what was happening in the temple. So we have this as the second time Jesus cleanses the temple. I mentioned that to you already. The first one's in John chapter 2, verse 14. Only recorded in John, where he had encountered these abuses the first time. He cleansed the temple there, I suppose to some extent, thinking that maybe they might have cleaned up their act a little bit. The temple ministry has again sunk to sheer commercialism and exploitation. The barren fig tree would have been a stark reminder of the barrenness of God's people. When Jesus arrives on the scene of the temple, he is not surprised, the second time, not fully prepared to defend the temple ministry. I mean, not the second time. The first time he came in and looked, now he's coming back to do something about it, even at the risk of his own life. We're reminded of our first ministry encounter with Jesus when he was only 12 years old. So this whole idea of concern for the temple was there from the beginning. The temple was a center of Jewish worship. It was a center of Jewish life. And if it was off kilter, it would affect everything. Remember, his parents leave Jerusalem without him, find him missing on the return trip to Jericho on the way home. It's a whole day's journey to find him in the temple discussing the scriptures with these sages. His parents, noticeably upset for delay and effort to return to Jesus, are placated when Jesus comments, "Why is it that you were looking for me? Do you not know I had to be in my Father's house?" So that zeal for the Lord's house characterized his ministry, and probably a characteristic of the lamb that we're examining that needs to be there. So we have Matthew 21:15 says, "And Jesus entered the temple and drove out all those who were buying and selling in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves. Now, in this case, we have no mention of scourges that we have mentioned in John chapter 2. So often you see John with the whip, and probably wasn't driving out the people with the whip. He's probably driving the animals out. Okay, so that is what we have in Matthew. Mark adds one little additional thing. He would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. And it's just probably just out of respect. Whatever comparison you want to make with churches or whatever, there's certain things you don't do in churches because out of respect. So they were just using this place as a business place. And when you do that, you've got products to bring in and products to take out. And in this case, we have live on foot animals. And I remember growing up on the farm, it doesn't always smell very good when you go on these farms or when you go to the 4-H, wonderfully clean, pristine floors, it still smells like farm animals. So that stench, no doubt, would have been in the room, in the air. Of course, I always think that the smells during this time must have been pretty bad anyway because of all the sacrificing that's going on. You can't keep everything perfectly clean. Kind of like I was in a grocery store to get my donut this morning. Why do grocery stores always have a smell to them? They got these rotten potato smells, you know, they just can't keep it clean. You know, no matter what they do, they still have that. So it's not a place where you want to have, you know, putrid smell. Anyway, so this was going on in the temple, and Jesus sees this, and he doesn't ask them to leave. He just walks in there and turns over the tables of the money changers. And we had the picture I started out with, and he drove out those that were selling doves, which were part of the sacrificial. You'd have goats or lambs. We talked about that. And then we also have the doves for poor people. And we're talking about thousands and thousands of people coming from all over the world for the Passover. We would have to have hundreds of animals somewhere being kept for sale, and pigeons kept for sale. So anyway, we have somewhat of a, I don't know what you call it, a shopping center in the temple mall. I don't know how they would exactly do this, except I think that Jesus would have said, you could have done this stuff. If you're going to do this stuff, you have to do it somewhere else rather than right in the temple. But it was convenient, you know. So here's kind of our plan of the temple, and we know this out of the Old Testament planning. And we do this, and we put it on top of the Temple Mount, which I think gets enormously big. It can't be that big. It doesn't need to be that big. So we have these courts that are out here that are just open spaces. Since we know about this colonnade, I know about this, I think, and then we know about this pattern, so what are you going to do with the rest? Well, you just make open space. And it has to fill up the Temple Mount, which is, you know, one of my favorite subjects. Is just wrong, because here's the Fortress of Antonio in the corner here, which is really what we're looking at. The temple's off here in the corner, or, you know, off to the left. So anyway, what we're looking at in the plan that I showed you, I'll go back to it, is this section right in here. And you see these 1, 2, 3, 4 corners. Got that? So I'll go back now. Those four corners are these four corners. It's called the Court of the Women. It means that, doesn't mean women, men can't go there, just that women could go here, but they couldn't go beyond this gate. And this was the gate where priests would go, and the men would, I guess, offer their sacrifices on behalf of the family. And then we have a spot in further on in where no one could go except the high priest here, right, that line there, once a year to go in at the day of Yom Kippur, and he would offer the sacrifices for the world. So inside here, just the priest would serve. Out here would be where the altar, where the sacrificial lambs would be served or sacrificed. So in this court is probably, what could have been outside here where this was going on, where the selling was going on. Okay, I read that for you. Sometimes this thing goes the wrong way, I found out. Why, I don't know. Now, after he does this, he makes a comment why he did this. Mark 11:17 gives us that, and so Mark 21:13. And he began to teach and say to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? But you have made it a robber's den. Now, it's really comforting to know that this house of prayer is for all the nations, which is another word for Gentiles. The house that is the house of prayer for the Jews is also supposed to be the house of prayer for the Gentile nations. And sure enough, if we look at Isaiah 56 and Isaiah 2, those two passages, we have it mentioned that in my holy mountain, verse 7, Isaiah 56, we have my holy mountain, of course, has to be the kingdom. And for even those I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer, their burnt offering and their sacrifice will be acceptable on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all the people. So we have sometimes gone, I don't know if we ever go too far, we just don't think about it probably, but we always think about everything's for the Jews. Well, not necessarily. It starts with the Jews and for the Jews to do certain things, but the Gentiles are included in the kingdom and they're included even in the house of prayer. Now, we say, well, that house was destroyed. Well, but if Jesus would have been accepted as Messiah, that would have been the house of prayer for the disciple, for the Gentiles as well. We also have the same prophetic comment here in the last days. Now, it will come about in the last days. The mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. Again, this millennial talk. And will be raised up above the other hills. Again, other nations. And all the nations, all again, the Gentiles will stream to it. So we have this promise that Jesus is making at this point that it's going to be a house of prayer for the world. Maybe there is an allusion here out of the Old Testament that the Jews would not have anticipated at this point. We're going to broaden this ministry at the last moment to include the Gentiles. We see this in a section we won't get today where the Gentiles come and Philip brings them and Andrew brings these Gentiles, these Greeks, to Jesus. Now, it doesn't say specifically what Jesus tells these Greeks, so we have to assume that what follows that request is honored by Jesus and that he teaches them, plus others. And it is a complete recap of everything that Jesus is doing. So maybe we're leaning into something. We're only a few days away from the crucifixion, really. Now, we don't say there's a church mentioned here, but the idea that the Gentiles become prominent enough to be mentioned makes us think that's what Jesus has in mind when he brings these up. And of course, he's quoting out of the Old Testament, so it wasn't a new idea at all. The Gentiles have always been part of God's plan. That's why I say sometimes we just get the idea that there's only the Jews. No, I think America has God's plan. It says all the nations will be represented. And I think someday that America will have their due, or England, or South Africa, or wherever. These countries will show up in the kingdom somehow with people from those kingdoms, and they will represent those kingdoms. I don't know how else we're going to take that except that way. So in some ways, what our nations do today does have an effect on their judgment. So it's not just, well, just the nations, God will wipe it all over. No, there is going to be a connection with what happens today and the people that occupy these nations and how they'll be blessed in the kingdom. We'll skip that because it's already said. Now, lest we get a little bit excited about this church for all nations, it is not this is the Garden of Gethsemane. It's not the nation, it's not the temple for the Gentiles, but it's interesting they probably borrow from that idea that this church was for all nations of the world, and that's fine to call it. It's where the prayer of Jesus supposedly occurs on that rock. It's built around over that rock. So I mentioned again, the Gentile nations have a purpose, even though it is different from Israel. They do have a responsibility, a duty to God to serve him. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and people to whom he has chosen for his own inheritance. See, there again, they will show up someday, and that's in Psalm 33:12. So their faithfulness will be remembered in the kingdom when they will be with the Jews, when with the Jews be worshiping in Jerusalem in the house of prayer for all nations. Even though there's a distinction between Israel and the church and the Gentiles for all ages, they still have a common point of worship. Now, I just pulled some things out of the commentaries. I can just talk to you about this, but give you an official writing. What's going on in the temple bazaar, or is that what they call it? What did Jesus actually object to when he walked in? Well, in it, the high priest Caiaphas had authorized a market, probably in a recent economic innovation, for the sale of ritually pure items necessary for the temple sacrifice, which would be wine, oil, salt. These would be approved, certified, labeled, sacrificial animals and birds. Now, to buy these animals, money from three sources circulated in Palestine in New Testament times. We had the imperial money, which would be Roman. We had the provincial money, which would be Greek, and local money, which is Jewish. Money changers provided the required Tyrian Jewish coinage for the annual half-shekel temple tax required of all male Jews 20 years up and up. You could not pay that with Roman money. You had to change it out into the temple script. It was in exchange for Greek and Roman currency, which featured human portraits, considered idolatrous by the Jews. Though a small surcharge was permitted in these transactions, they probably could eject them up a little bit. Dealings were not free from extortion and fraud. In addition, according to Mark 11:16, people loaded with merchandise were taking shortcuts through this area, making it a thoroughfare from one part of the city to another. No respect for the temple. So Jesus was outraged by this blatant disregard for the temple area specifically set apart for Gentile use. So he overturned the money changers, tables and the dove sellers, benches, and would not allow people to use the area as a thoroughfare. Other certified markets were available elsewhere in the city. So when Jesus entered the temple area, the smell of animals entered his nostrils and the noise of the money changers' tables beat on his ears. For the convenience of pilgrims and cattlemen and money changers had set up businesses in the court of the Gentiles. The animals were sold for sacrifice. It was far easier for a pilgrim in Jerusalem to purchase one that was guaranteed kosher. And, you know, they were the ones that decided whether it was kosher or not. And if it came from a long way and you brought your own, it would never quite mustered. I mean, it was just ability to be corrupt. Guaranteed kosher than to bring an animal with them and have it inspected for meeting the kosher requirements, and on the way probably get soiled, injured, or whatever. So they probably just waited and bought things when they got there. The Roman money the pilgrims brought to Jerusalem had to be exchanged into the currency and the closest thing to the old Hebrew shekel, since the annual temple tax had to be paid in that currency. Exorbitant prices were often charged for changing the currency. By overturning the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, Jesus was directly challenging the authority of the high priest, because they were there by his authority. They were there, those men were there selling the stuff by his authorization. In John's first account, Jesus drove them out with a whip and made from pieces of rope. So that's the experience. And again, it doesn't work very well with the mild Jesus, does it? And sometimes we have difficulty, they have difficulty with reconciling this person that never ever said raised his voice. But we have these experiences where obviously there were things that were very, very, very important. And he did raise his voice and he did take action and he actually got physical with the tables and drove out the animals. So after everything settled, I imagine it would have taken a while for them to leave. As well as kind of, there's got to be more to the story. Jesus walks in and does it for some tables and everybody vanishes. Apparently, you know, he has that power, that authority that no one else had. And no one speaks like this man and that kind of thing. So it probably took a while for them to get out, and then everybody's sort of standing around in awe. So what's going on here? And Jesus now uses this time as a teaching opportunity. And he was teaching daily. Now this expression from Luke again expresses a general pattern of Jesus, and it would have been appropriate at this time too to teach in the temple. But the chief priests and the scribes and the leading men among the people were trying to destroy him, but they could not find anything that they might do, for all the people were hanging on every word he said. So we have them in a conundrum, and they don't know what to do. So they just basically have to let it go on. All right. So I think the lesson is really quite familiar to us, so I got to think, well, what are their Are there any comparisons that there would be in the church that we would say would be warnings for us as a temple of God, a place where we worship, that would have this kind of admonition, you know, directed towards us? Now, maybe we can't look at our church. Maybe we should look at our church. Or maybe we should just look at general Christian practices. And I'm going to let you participate. What are some comparisons that you could make in the church where the same thing was happening, or maybe it never happened, if you think that?
Bingo.
What?
Bingo.
Bingo. Bingo in church? I didn't think about bingo in the church. All right. Now, does the church get a little cut on the bingo? Probably. I don't know. We never did play bingo in church. Played it at home. Yeah.
Non-biblical classes where they bring in things and charge money for to learn about psychology or how to pay your taxes or all of the self-help things that come in.
Okay, would you... Now, you bring up an interesting point there. Where you charge for a class? Exactly. Would you think it's all right to charge for a class that would be appropriate?
Yes.
Okay, but not inappropriate. Okay, so does it make a difference to who you hold this class out to? In other words, to the public or to the inside people?
How are the unchurched going to learn if they don't have an opportunity to come to a class like that? Right? There's sometimes people just come in off the street for your classes on Wednesday night.
Yeah, now the thing that saves my neck is I don't charge for it.
True. But what
I don't get many tips, let's put it that way.
Well, what the charge for is, I presume, is for books, for the study helps that you have. They can, and the hucksters can sell anything.
Okay,
that's what I'm talking about.
So I think what we're needing to draw a little bit of a line here between making money on the deal or just paying expenses. We have it in our training program, Solomon's Portico. You have to buy your books, and you even pay a little extra than your books, which is supposed to help defray costs that are incurred. So that's okay. That's okay. And if people were coming from outside the church and participated, would that be okay? They'll be okay too. Okay, just bingo's not good here. Okay, all right. Okay, it preaches that preach health and wealth on the basis of give me your money and God will make you rich, that type of pattern. Okay, that would be extortion. It'd be actually what it's called, lying. Okay. How about historically?
Martin Luther.
Who said that? Our good Lutheran over here. Guess what I have up? Martin Luther and the sale of indulgence. In fact, I think that's even worse than what's going on in the temple. Because John Tetzel was actually selling gateways into heaven. I'm not sure that's what was happening in the Jewish temple, but maybe in some sense they were, because they were buying these animals that was supposed to, in their perverted mind, think they would get to heaven, but never got to heaven on the base of an animal. Yeah, I thought about, that's the first thing that came to my mind, is if I think back in church history, think, well, the selling of indulgences was worse. I mean, you could actually buy your way into heaven? I mean, come on. People, you really think that's true? I was like, how ignorant can you be? I mean, I guess as ignorant as you want to be. That's kind of how I figured this out. As ignorant as you want to be. Okay, Jerry.
Wouldn't buying your relative's way out of heaven be the stuff?
Okay, what do you call those things? Catholic people, anybody? You pay for buying these candles. What's the word for that? Not indulgences, no. I know what you mean. You buy money, pay money, and then you have these people out of purgatory for a few more seconds or whatever. At least you move them closer to the door, but we don't know how close they are yet.
Reparation?
Reparation, yeah, I don't. I mean, there isn't a word for it. Maybe there is. I can't think of what it is. Okay, but that'd be a good example. In fact, we'll go to Israel and we'll see them in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They have a bundle of these little candles, and they're going to light them at the altar there, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or with the, I shouldn't say the altar, it's where the burial chamber is, supposedly. They'll light them, then blow them out and take all these things back home to people, because they will have some grace with them, because this has been done in Jerusalem. And I say, you want to think that makes a difference? Then I got to let me examine your head a little bit. You believe what you want to believe here. Okay, more? That's what we got here. This indulgences, yeah. They came in. How's that little saying go? When the coin hits the coffer and the tingle, you know, some souls released from hell and all this kind of things.
How about the healing people have these passive?
Well, especially if you charge for it. Even if they don't charge for it, there is a enslavement that occurs that's inappropriate. I mean, if they get healed, which they never do, I don't know how that ministry goes, those kind of ministries goes on, because there's absolutely no validity to it. But again, you believe what you want to believe.
Paul's day, I don't remember which church they're having a good communion.
In Paul's day, in Corinthians? Yeah. Well, they were chastising them for making the communion service a feast day. And so don't you have homes to eat in rather than do this? That was, they perverted the church. Yeah, it'd be kind of like that. I'm not sure anybody made money on it. That's probably what we want to see here is where are they making money on this thing? Well, I thought about, how do you fund the church? How do churches get funded? There really are some churches actually raise money by selling things. Maybe that's what your point was. In other words, we need some money to operate, so we'll go into some kind of business and sell things. I always think it's difficult for a church really to make enough money doing anything to support it, because it's an expensive operation. It is an expensive operation. Anytime you start paying salaries, you start paying a lot of money. And you got to buy property and all that kind of stuff. So fundraising in the church, I think, in the Bible, is all voluntary. I remember... Maybe this was true for the Lutherans too, but I know it was certainly the Mennonites, that your churches were supported by a church assessment. If you own land, you had to pay. Did you ever do that in Lutheran churches years ago? Probably did. You're probably too young to remember that. But that was typical out of Europe, you know, where the church of landed people actually supported these local parishes. And I know that when I was young, no one was paying it anymore, so they just dropped it. And it probably wasn't a good thing anyway. It became an assessment. So the people that had land paid for the operation of the church, or a large part of it. The people didn't have land didn't. That didn't seem to be right. I mean, it's just something that all of a sudden you had a city church. What are you going to do? No one owning any land. Tax their houses. So it's kind of an informal tax. The church seems to be supported by voluntary giving. And that's how it functions. Not by making money. I talk about what is the teaching. I'll put these all up here so I think about it. What is any sale of any item prohibited in a church? Well, I got to be careful here, because we sell. What do we now sell? Cookie dough? Well, the board's been careful here to say that whatever we do sell in church here isn't really meant to support the ministry. It helps people that are involved in extra ministry events, like children's ministry camps and so forth, that are not really part of the, I kind of use the word core program, but are ancillary. If they're optional, then they can be. You can raise money for that. Again, there no one's salaries being paid out of this. It makes these kids that go to camp their expenses a little bit less. So we, in a way, that's a way to help them. There'd be some church that probably wouldn't allow it. I know that probably in the days of the church we grew up, probably wouldn't have allowed any sale of any kind of thing at all, even a bake sale. I don't think. Do you think there? I don't ever remember anything like that in churches.
How about now?
Well, we have them right in our own church. We have bake sales, so yeah.
I think there's somewhat. It's just my opinion. Leeway within the church. It's when you start doing something in the church that reaches out for profit. Amongst outside the church.
Right, I think that's that was Larry they who left's point, yeah.
Stuff like that, I think there's a certain leeway and a responsibility to it. It's when you bring the outside in.
Well, that for sure would seem like cross the line. To follow up with Marty's, I have a little bit, a tinge of wondering whether we ought to do that. I still have that. I'm not going to protest it at all. I don't, not that, but it's just easy for somebody else to take it a little bit further, and that's why I say, well, you know, that's all they do now, but wait till you see what they're going to do next generation. Well, that may be true. So, but I don't know if that's a big deal. I guess it's part of what we depend on in our local church. We have good, solid Bible teaching. If we didn't have that, then this line could easily slide. And when solid Bible teaching ceases to be given off at this pulpit, that is a place where that could start sliding. So I give you the rationale here. That's not part of the... If it's part of what you have to have, the Board of Elders set up what you ought to have in this church, all of that is free. No one can charge that. But if there are some things that some of the organizations in the church want to do on behalf of their constituency, like camps, that's the only two things I know that we do, I think, they're permitted to do it. They keep, I think, at least that was one of my big problems I had when I was a staff person, to keep those monies separate from the regular church offerings, because it's so easy to be like the federal government. All of a sudden you have a lock box and nothing in it. You know, all the money gets pooled. I said, I always was bothered by that. So I did a lot of work on fund accounting, that these funds have their own accounting systems, and that's very complicated in a nonprofit. So I got out just in time. There was a hand back here, I think, somewhere. Well, the book sales are sold at our cost plus 5%. So they're really...
I mean the used book sale.
Oh. Right. We're not culling books and not selling certain books. That's true. Well, I think probably the argument would go this way, and I probably have to say I agree with it. I think when it comes to books, they're different than ideas that are presented in person. I mean, we all need to know how to deal with books, good ones and bad ones. So when you pick up a book, you almost have to understand what it is. And to some extent, if you buy a book at the book sale, in our book sale, which books come from who knows where, and maybe there are some that are culled, I don't know. But I have bought books here that are bad books for reference purposes. I just need to read what that says rather than wonder what it said. But again, that money, whatever goes to Sound Words that actually supports the book ministry here. So it isn't anybody's salary being paid. And well, I know we have Twyla back there. She's being paid. But she, tell you what, she never gets her salary paid for by the book sales. So there's still a subsidized operation. It was when I was, I can't imagine being different today. So, but those are things that are interesting to think about. So do book sales work here? And I think it's always good. We did this a lot as a staff person. Think through these practices to see whether they're still are still good or could be improved upon, and some of it comes from you folks. You know, if you hear a lot of this, why do we have this here? You know, and I don't think it's right. It's not a good testimony, whatever. I'm sure the board will finally respond to that if that's how it comes across. For me, I'd love to go to bookstores at Gateway Mall and buy books there because they're cheap. And sometimes if the good books that no one else wants, I want. Here, opposite, good books get sold here right away, and they're sold at a really, really good price. And I know we had a lady die in her estate, and they left the stuff, and a lot of her books are going to be sold at the, you know, this summer on their sale. So it's one way to get rid of things that you don't know what to do. That's what my book's going to end up doing. They'll be on the estate sale here at church sometimes because no one's got room for them in their house. So anybody else? Oh, we're out of time already. A point of contention probably with other bookstores when we started it. We had a friend that used to be part of a church, started a bookstore in town, and when he had his own bookstore, then he got upset with us having a bookstore. But it was okay when he was in church, our church, to have a bookstore, but when he left, all of a sudden, we shouldn't have a bookstore. So you kind of look into that and say, okay, all right. So, but we don't have a commercial license here. We don't have licensing for a commercial bookstore. So our argument is basically the bookstore is our ministry. It's part of our ministry and therefore not subject to it. So we can't put a SoundWords advertisement out in front. And I don't think you can put a SoundWords advertisement in your window because we're not really a commercial outlet for the general public. Where's Larry's point again? Now, people come in, buy books that are from the general public, which generally are Christians. They're not, you know, the atheists aren't coming here to stock up on literature unless they're doing research. So we sell it to anybody who comes in here. And to some extent, people understand that we're a ministry to the broader Christian community than just our own church. If we have books in our church that there's nowhere else in Lincoln that has them. I don't know, we'd go to Omaha to get them. I don't even know what Grace College is anymore. They used to have a good bookstore, but you know, everything's gone psychology these days and everything is experienced living, so you don't have a lot of serious works. And we try to keep good stuff. There are some stuff that we have there that we'd have 5-point Calvinism stuff, you know, some of that stuff, but you gotta be a little bit aware again of what you're reading and what kind of book you're reading. And of course, if you know, don't know, you always can ask. And I always think who the author is as important as anything in the book is who wrote it. And if you know this person is amillennial, then you'll expect that in his writing and be prepared for it. All right. Well, that took a longer time than I thought. So we have coming up, I reprieve, we do that, then that. And then we have this, our next section. Now, there were Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. These then came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida, which is a Greek name, near a Greek city. The Decapolis, those 10 Greek cities. He was from Bethesda of Galilee and began to ask him, saying, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." And there's been a lot of sermons made on that statement, which is probably appropriate. So then we have Jesus' response to this, and which is quite extensive. In fact, it's the rest of chapter 12. So we'll decide whether we're going to start that next week or not. And you'll have to find out by just coming to find out. And I guess we're done. I'll pray. Lord, thank you for the morning and for the opportunity again to visit about things that are important to us because they're important to you. Thank you, Lord, for this local church and the way you have raised it up and how that you funded and provided for it. Lord, it's an ongoing, not a struggle necessarily, but ongoing work that needs to be given, attention needs to be given to so that we can continue to function in a biblical way. Wonderful facilities we have and wonderful staff that serves us. Lord, thank you for those features that come about because they've been funded by faithful people on a voluntary basis. Lord, that's the way you expected it, and that's the way we function, and we'll continue to do that until you come. Thank you, Lord, for the gospel. Lord, for the Christ that died on the cross for us. Lord, we're studying his life. We study the last days of his life on earth as a human being, with the glory of the divine person veiled from us yet. But Lord, a few more days after the resurrection, we'll see him in his great glory. So again, thank you for blessing us so much with our health. For those that are suffering from health problems, pray Jim, give him strength today. And then Dara, she takes care of him and others in the family that are all affected by it. And for others, Lord, that we don't mention now, but we are aware of, pray that you might bless them and keep them strong physically and most of all, strong spiritually. Dismiss us now as we go to the church for the worship service that follows, for Gilly preaches, and every aspect of it may we honor you with everything that's done. May our hearts be prepared to receive the work of the Spirit. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.